Hello, and welcome back for another episode of the Botchtuber podcast. Today, we are joined by Andrew Behrendt, currently an assistant teaching professor at the Missouri University of Science and Technology. Much of Behrendt's research has focused on East Central Europe, with a strong connection to Austria and Hungary. In this episode, he discusses his recent work looking at interwar tourism from the United States to Austria, and the complex relationship between tourism promoters, Americans perceived as rich tourists, and a country struggling to rebuild its identity following the dissolution of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I am your host, Luke Morgante, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Okay, so Andrew, it's very nice to talk to you again since we first met at the American Agents in Austria conference that the Botchtuber Institute ran in conjunction with the University of Vienna this summer. While we were there, I got to see some of your presentation on American tourism and its relationship with interwar Austria. And I thought it was extremely interesting. And I was hoping that you could kind of introduce yourself and what your historical interests have been, and then how the idea came about for this topic.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you, Luke, and thank you to the foundation. It's a pleasure now, and it was a pleasure then, and I'm glad to be able to sit down and talk to you in a little more detail and one-on-one about this project and the whole milieu out of which it arose. So thanks again. So yeah, what is my deal? I always have to try to think about how I orient my self-presentation as a scholar and a researcher, because principally, my job at the Missouri University of Science and Technology is to teach, and especially to teach survey courses and a whole variety of upper division survey type things. And in some ways, my life as a researcher of modern East Central Europe is I don't want to say peripheral to that, because it's not, but it's sort of in a different sphere of the cosmos. So I would say this, I am indeed a historian of modern East Central Europe, particularly Austria, Hungary, and the broader Habsburg world, especially in the post-imperial period, 1918 to, you know, about 1938 or 1944, depending on which country I am thinking about at that time, but also dipping back into the 19th century as the circumstances dictate, which, you know, in thinking about 1918 as being or not being some kind of caesura in the history of the region and the history of these states can get kind of blurry and it's mobile. So that's another reason why I kind of phase in and out of my various identities. As far as my research topics go, as a graduate student, my dissertation was on tourism and cinema, or really tourism and movie going in Austria and Hungary between the two world wars. And so that marks me as a cultural historian, but also as a social historian, or maybe as kind of light social historian, since I didn't do the kind of big numbers the way that it once had been. Not that I'm uninterested in those things, but cultural, social. You know, so in the end, my interest in tourism and movie going, which I'll explain why I very precisely call it movie going, is a bigger project of trying to understand the textures, the contours, and the lived realities of the complicated shift from being a multinational empire to suddenly not being one, and to trying to understand what it's like to be in these countries that are now independent countries. And in the case of Austria, that's a very stark change. And in the case of Hungary, it's a bit more of a graduated transition, and trying to think about how tourism forces people to reflect on where they live, and trying to promote it and trying to imagine what it's like to travel within new boundaries or kind of recast boundaries. And so I found it a good way of focusing the question of what is it like to be in a place that is no longer the place it was even just a few years ago. The movie going part, it was my way of trying to get at tourism for people who could not afford to be tourists. And in this period of time, and I think we'll be talking about this when we get to the Botchtuber conference paper, is that although tourism is on the rise globally, and especially in Europe, in the United States, in the 1920s and 30s, and you know, obviously takes off way, way much greater beyond 1945, is that still most people can't afford that experience, either in terms of time or money or, you know, various other kinds of material and social circumstances. But movie going and film appreciation is something which is highly, highly accessible and is, you know, at even in the 20s and in the 30s, probably, you know, second or maybe even number one in terms of media consumption for the general population. And so it occurred to me that movies would be a good way to understand how stationary tourists, or as I call them in my work, virtual tourists, are able to witness, experience, be told about, get some impression of tourist hotspots without actually having to go anywhere. And that aspect doesn't show up in this particular paper, but that is part of the broader context of the work that I've done. You know, in terms of my other work that I've done, this has kind of spun out to an interest in cuisine and food history, and then in sort of more distant to this question, but as a part of my own scholarly trajectory, I've also become much more interested in video games, and in particular video games as a historiographical medium and as a medium for understanding the philosophy of history on a popular level. I think I'll leave it at there, but I think that's a fair précis of my intellectual world that I inhabit.
I think that's a good description, and it's very multifaceted within the cultural historian realm.
Yeah, sometimes it feels quite fragmented, but it was really, really great to go to Vienna and be a part of that conference and be a part of a community of people who are really zeroed in on a place and a time, and to commune with people who are, you know, experts in this relatively narrow realm. And it's good to feel grounded in time and place.
With this project on American tourism and its relationship, or American tourism to Austria during this period, one of the interesting points you make is how much more Americans were going to countries like France and other mm-hmm. major powers in Europe around Austria. And Austria was somewhat interested in getting some of that traffic or building on what they already had.
Absolutely. Yeah. To say that Austrians were interested, I'll just say that when I say Austrians, I really mean specifically the Austrian press in its various facets, and quite vaguely, kind of have to vaguely refer to as tourism promoters, people in various positions and industries and official capacities who have an invested interest in trying to get people to be tourists in Austria, or to at least use the institutions and facilities of travel. And those people and the way that those interests are reflected in the press in the 1920s and 30s, especially in the 1920s, are deeply, deeply, almost sometimes, I think, rabidly interested in trying to get Americans to come to Austria. One of the frustrations, and we can talk about this later on, is that they aren't coming in quite the numbers that they would like.
Does the discrepancy between American tourists to Austria and these other countries, to what extent is that because Austria, following World War I, becomes a much smaller country population-wise, and what the economy is actually able to withstand in terms of tourism? And to what extent is that Americans just not being as interested in going to Austria versus the advertisements they're constantly seeing of Paris or of London?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And it's one of those questions that I am still working on, because with focusing on tourism promoters as the agents of interest for me, it's not always easy to distinguish their anxieties and neuroses and their own diagnoses of the problem versus what we might say might be a more objective or, you know, kind of material realities. I think it's a combination of all these factors. One of them is that, as you say, Austria being smaller has within its technical boundaries a lot fewer of the tourist magnets that it once had as the Habsburg Empire. I mean, you don't have the Adriatic coast anymore. There aren't the spas in Bohemia, Moravia. You don't have even the growing spas in Transylvania or Lake Balaton in Hungary and these places, or the Tatras in the Polish lands. And so suddenly now Austria being much smaller, I mean, it still has the Alps and it still has the Salzkammergut and other important tourist spots. But thinking about where Americans might want to go or anyone might want to go, the parameters are narrower. But in this particular paper, what really comes to the fore is the fact that Austria is, as I describe it in the paper itself, an economic basket case for much of the later 19 teens and into the mid 1920s. And it's a country that has lost a lot of its export capacity, that has a revenue problem, and that has perhaps above all an inflation problem. And so what emerges is this idea of Americans who are not only imagined to be universally rich, basically, but rich with a stable and now hegemonic currency that spends everywhere, whereas the krona or later the shilling is very tenuous. And so Americans in the eyes of Austrian tourism promoters are looked upon as I describe in another paper in the Hungarian context, golden pheasants, that they are almost kind of mythical, wondrous, miraculous creatures who, if they come in the right numbers, can shower economic benefits on a country that desperately needs some kind of economic boost. One of the thoughts about tourism that also comes to the fore is that it is what might be called like a silent export or an invisible export, where you're not actually shipping anything anywhere, but you're still addressing the balance of payments by having people bring the payments to you using the things that you've already got there. And one of the things in Austria's favor, despite the fact that it's smaller, despite all the incredible disruptions and instabilities, financial and otherwise, of the late teens and early 20s, is that there still is a fairly robust, if developing, tourist infrastructure that had been built up during the Habsburg period that you're able to now try to build up further and bring these Americans to come and enjoy, whether that's in Vienna or it's in the Alps.
So following all this destruction and the economic woes of the period, Austrians are seeking to bring these wealthy Americans in for that financial stability and regrowth. What was tourism at this point in history? How is it different than tourism today? And who was an average American tourist at that time? Their wealth that much greater than the average tourist from elsewhere to Austria? Or was that a misperception and so on?
Again, excellent questions. And still things that are, I'm still working on trying to find the shading those details, because it's not always easy to, I mean, look, in the 20s and 30s, states and international agencies are collecting data on tourists, but it's not the level that we're accustomed to today, where you can get, micro-targeted analyses of demographic subgroups and so forth. But what is tourism? Well, first of all, one of the difficulties is determining who is a tourist versus who is merely a traveler, who happens to be interacting with the transportation infrastructure, with hotels, with, things that are tourism adjacent. And there is basically no way to differentiate those things in the numbers that we have. And they probably still aren't even today. But as far as either self-identified tourists or the imagined tourist that comprises this market, we're talking about middle class, upper middle class, and the haute bourgeoisie and the international aristocracy who are able to travel and to spend time. I mean, time is also a very important resource here in not working. And so the imagined American tourist that emerges in the research that I've done is someone who sits kind of in between, a wealthy East Coast American or some kind of Chicago pork magnate, all the way up to, the real billionaires and sort of Hollywood type figures. The actual people who are traveling, it's a little harder to tell. The range of money that Americans spend while they're abroad in Europe varies pretty wildly, as you can imagine, from people who are trying to go to Austria because it's cheap to people who, for whom money is no object. But what they're doing is in Austria, they're going to Vienna to see they're going to see old stuff, to put it, you know, succinctly, whether that is the still fresh remnants of the Habsburg monarchy and being able to tour around, you know, the Hofburg or the imperial apartments or Sisi's old haunts or whatever, or the Kapuzinergruft or something like that, or going to the Alps for skiing or to the Salzkammergut for hanging out in a spa or by the lakes. It's a combination of these things, of sort of physical relaxation associated with health cures, but also of a chance to see kind of the tail end of one of Europe's, one of the world's great monarchical dynasties, while, you know, the proverbial dirt is still settling on the grave. So that is what Americans seem to be doing there in various places and in various levels of intensity and intensities of spending.
Today, if you are talking to the average American, they probably don't have a deep understanding of Austria, the culture, the country, maybe, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, The Sound of Music, or a few other things, but there's not much of a deep understanding within the general social consciousness of Americans. And was this different at the time? I believe you mentioned that the American tourist would see Austria as its former imperial self, which I don't think that there is even much of a connection between Austria and the Habsburg Empire among Americans today. So how is that different?
Yeah. Again, this is one of those things where right now I'm still kind of contending with them. I don't want to say it's a mirage, but the image of the American as it is reflected in the Austrian press. And the image that comes in the press articles that I've read is, as you say, Americans who are the image of Austria that they get comes through listening to waltzes. It comes through their, and remember, these being middle and upper class Americans, like their education that they've gotten in classical music, in, you know, high art, in literature, and in operettas as well. And so they get this sort of Franz Lehár, Strauss sort of image of Austria as this romantic world of cavaliers and dances and, I don't know, courtly affairs, perhaps, you know, occasionally wearing lederhosen or something like that. And one of the things that comes up in the press occasionally in the 1920s is that Americans, you know, it's all fine and good for Americans to like that idea, and that gets them to come. But when they get there, they might be disappointed because that is not the Austria of the 1920s and the 1930s, at least not in the way that they, in this romanticized picture of it that they have. And so one of the questions is, how do we advertise Austria as it really is, so that when Americans come, they have a realistic picture that will keep them there and keep them coming back to appreciate the real Austria, as opposed to simply a storybook picture of it.
So the economic draw of bringing in these American tourists for the tourism promoters was clearly there. Was this optimism or desire to bring in Americans shared by the average Austrian, do you think? The surprising thing to me when looking at it is how close to the end of World War I that American tourism to Austria started to rise. And you would just assume that any two countries that were recently at war together, there would be some leftover animosity between the people. But it didn't seem to be the case as much.
It doesn't seem to be the case. And I wish that I could give you a nice clear picture of, you know, the so-called average Austrian. And you know, this is one of the limitations of my research so far, is that because I'm looking principally through press accounts, you know, that very much structures the interests and the viewpoints that I'm able to get at. But it is striking that in any case, I haven't encountered any indications of, and whether, you know, this is actually the way things were, or whether these things are happening but are suppressed. But I don't think so. I think that there isn't a lot of bad blood that emerges. For one thing, I mean, the Austrians and the Austro-Hungarians and the American forces, they don't really directly fight very much, almost not at all in the war. So, I mean, that's part of it. Germany is by far the greater enemy in American propaganda and the American conception of the war. And I think also part of it is that no one even Austrians themselves are entirely clear what an Austrian is in the 1920s. And so it becomes, you know, fragmented into all the different ethnic and now independent national groups. And so I think there's a lot of points of diffusion where I don't want to say the slate is wiped clean, but it's almost like they're starting over. And Austria has the burden not of trying to overcome animosity, but trying to overcome ignorance, like we've been talking about, and trying to establish what Austria is for Americans so that they would want to come and visit there. The response in the press is, I don't want to say it's universally positive, but in the sense that there are frustrations with Americans, either because they aren't coming in the numbers that they would we want them to come, or because... So I was going to say that, you know, there are frustrations either because Americans aren't coming in the numbers that the promoters would like them to come, or because occasionally they are a bit crude, making slight, you know, fools of themselves as rubes, as being rich, but not necessarily very cultured, or not as cultured as you might think, despite their wealth, saying kind of ignorant things or half-educated things in art galleries, always being very concerned with how much money they're spending, or, you know, kind of worried about tipping the right way, or being demanding as far as the quality of hotels and the material conditions. I mean, there is also a subcurrent which I'm investigating now in expanding this paper, which I was really turned on to in a big way thanks to the conference, is that there is, in other aspects of Austrian culture, particularly in the works of Ugo Bettauer, this idea of the Dollar Uncle, or the American Uncle, the sort of proverbial rich relation who has either left Austria or is a second generation Austrian American and comes back loaded with cash. And there's this anxiety about whether these Americans are simply going to be able to impose their cultural values and their way of life and their, you know, their standards of living on these poor Austrians who are desperate to get the money, but it's not entirely clear that this is going to be a mutually beneficial transaction as much as the now, you know, hegemonic Americans pushing themselves around and in this new Austria, and especially in Vienna.
That kind of reminds me of the idea of soft power. And I was actually wondering if you could kind of talk about what soft power actually is and how it may fit into this relationship between Austria and the US at the time.
Yeah, I mean, so my understanding of soft power is that it, you know, it is a way of either consciously or unconsciously exerting influence diplomatically, but also culturally, economically, on places, kind of steering them through razzle-dazzle, through inducements, through kind of demonstrating the goodness or even superiority of a certain way of life or a certain set of cultural markers and cultural values, and endearing one group of people to that group which has this power. So theoretically, the United States being able to, through tourism, kind of show Austrians a quote-unquote better way of life, the American way of life, and all its benefits. And I think that there is this happening in the sense that Austrians, in trying to get Americans to come to Vienna and Austria as a whole, are having to imagine what Americans want. They have to imagine what their relationship to that stuff is. And so, are our hotels good enough? Do we have enough cars for them to ride around in, because Americans are obsessed with cars. They don't walk as much as we do. And they're saying this in 1924, and they could be saying that easily as much, if not more, 100 years ago. Things like this. But one of the things that was striking to me in working on this paper is that there is very little, almost none, in terms of overt ideological discussions. The Austrian press is not really wringing its hands too much about Americanization. And I don't get much of a sense that the American tourists have any interest at all in trying to promote a particular way of life. Now, I think that when we talk about Hugo Bettauer, for example, that there is this aspect of anxiety over Americanization is present, just not in what the newspapers that I've looked at. And there are soft power aspects of American institutions. You know, there are permanent kind of American, there's an American house in a facility, a kind of a big complex in Vienna closely associated with the many American physicians who come to do residencies and extra training at the General Hospital or at the University of Vienna. And I think that there are ways in which you have more formal soft power at work. But within tourism itself and in the resources that I've looked at, it's very muted. And it really does seem to boil down to these are rich people. They want to spend their money. They're spending their money in increasing amounts over the 1920s in Paris, in London, in Italy, in Switzerland. Why can't we just bring more of them over? It's not that far, really, right? How hard could it be for them to come to Vienna? How do we get them to shower some of that wealth and spend some, you know, nights in our hotels?
I think that was perfectly explained. You made it very clear. I guess that leads to when the promoters are creating advertisements for Americans, how are they going about doing that? Is it a flyer that says, these are the good things about Austria, this is why you should come? What are the modes of advertising for that? And what differentiates an advertisement to visit a country from actual propaganda for that country?
The word propaganda, one of the fascinating things about working on tourism in this period is that propaganda is not a dirty word. That is the word that promoters use, whether they are people in the industry or government officials or whoever. They use that word synonymously with advertising. And so they want propaganda. They want to have good propaganda. And sometimes they'll talk about advertisements, but really their vision is kind of trying to send out these waves of positive images that will resonate with some market. Now, as to your question about what does that look like, another fascinating thing about the 1920s and 30s is that it's changing and it's becoming more modernized and it's becoming more refined. And so I talk about this a bit in the conference paper, how, and this goes back to one of your earlier questions, how are they trying to get Americans to come and why are they, what do they blame for the fact that Americans aren't coming in the numbers that they would like, is that some Austrian promoters are convinced that we just don't have good enough propaganda. We're not reaching the American audience. And so what some things that we see happen are kind of direct campaigns of trying to create English language pamphlets that can be put into American travel agency offices in New York and in the East Coast cities and in Chicago and in San Francisco and places where rich Americans might be coming from, trying to target things in a way that would be specifically appealing for them. There's one article that I read, I forget, sometime in the early 1930s, crowing about how an Austrian agency was able to place a spot on NBC radio in the United States so that there would be, you know, sort of a 15-minute segment talking about the Austria as a tourist destination, and this would, you know, go across the airwaves. There's also experiments in working in film promotion. I don't talk about that in the paper, but creating little silent features that could be sent out and edited into newsreels and played before movies in the United States, or in one case, there's this whole series of silent movies that the Austrian Postbus, you know, the post office bus system creates. It has these virtual travels from one town to the next and one spot to the next. These things are kind of edited and played in a digested format on cruise ships as they come or just passenger ships as they come across the Atlantic, so that, you know, while travelers are being entertained, they're also being propagandized too. In my presentation in Vienna, I had a few images of posters done in a sharp kind of 1930s sort of deco style. Those are interesting because there's like a single set of them which are produced in the early 1930s, and the images stay the same and the language changes, so that if they want to appeal to German-speaking tourists, they'll make the captions in German or in French or in Italian or in English as the needs demand. And so it's a really kind of dynamic time for tourism promotion because of the sense that tourism is becoming more democratized. This is a word that comes up pretty frequently, that more people are traveling, so you need to be able to appeal to them in more modern ways.
I found it interesting that the language changed, but the images did not over time. Were the tourists from the United States often German speakers, or would it be more common to hire a translator or something upon arrival? How did that happen at the time?
I don't know, Luke. That's a really good question. I've tried to dig into memoirs and other travel accounts of Americans coming over and more Anglophones more broadly. I've also done some stuff with British tourists. And it really just depends why people are there. I think like these physicians who are coming over to spend time in Austria, many of them have had some German. German being a really important language of scientific communication. You know, whether they were fluent in it is another question, but probably were more inclined to learn it then than today. And since these are, you know, tourists coming from the middle and upper classes, they have a greater intensity of language training just as kind of their class upbringing than they might have today. And it's only, you know, you only sort of get sense a little bit that in the 20s and 30s that English is becoming more of a dominant and more universal language. But I think that there's a bigger expectation that they'll have to know some German at least. But I don't know on an individual level whether that constitutes any kind of majority. I doubt it, but they probably enough of them had some enough German to get by or had the resources, yeah, to hire someone to guide them along the way.
That's definitely changed as well.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You know, it's always fun to present on tourism, in historical tourism in the modern era. And compare the experiences, you know, going to a place like the airport in Vienna, where you just, everything's multilingual and it's very, very easy to get around as a non-German speaker. Although I am a German speaker, you can just tell that it's such a cosmopolitan, you know, globalized space. And then you get back to the United States and everything is simply in English, occasionally maybe in Spanish. And you, coming back to the idea of soft power, you know, the century of transformation, I think you can really get that sense of how English and the English-speaking world has, in a way, I don't want to, if the word triumph is really the right word, but has reached such a kind of ascendancy that these questions of language in a place like Vienna or in a major tourist destination almost don't matter as long as you know English.
Yeah, that's crazy.
it is, but you know, that's why looking, and I think that's one of the things I wanted to do with this paper and this project more broadly is get a sense of what those early days are like right after World War I, when the United States is, it seems very clear to probably most international observers that now the United States has entered into this position which it had never been before, not only being a huge industrial power, and obviously one of the great powers of the world, but a power which is directly engaged with in various ways, specifically or not, in Europe and around the world in a way that it hadn't been before. It's striking to see Austrians and Austrian tourism promoters talk very frankly about how we're a busted country, right? We don't have a lot of money. We're sort of barely on our feet politically, but here we have this titanic country, the United States, which is, you know, the only country to come out of World War I, basically, of a belligerent power that isn't deeply in debt. I mean, that's a lender country. It's able to exert this influence and this power in an amazing way. And to see the United States then as not necessarily like a cultural model, but definitely as a, you want to be on the good side of its tourists. You want to get them to come to you because that way you can get a little piece of that global power, at least financially.
What was the process of researching for this paper like, going and finding all these old pieces of, I guess, like benevolent propaganda and the different reports that were written at the time? How difficult was it? What kinds of surprises were there? Were there any odd occurrences that don't really replicate anywhere else?
Yeah, so I guess I'll just zoom out and tell a little bit about how this particular paper came to be, because it's a spinoff from my dissertation. And that itself was a process of trying to amass And I'll just say this, like the process of researching this kind of material has changed a lot in just the last 10 to 15 years. Because when I went to do my research first in 2010, 2011, in Budapest and in Vienna, basically everything you had to get in physical copies by going to the Austrian National Library or its Hungarian equivalent and looking at things either on microfilm or in the physical media itself and hoping that, you know, every issue that you take out might have something useful in it and trying to take pictures of everything possible or write notes of whatever you can get at. And so this meant just trying to gobble up as many tourism promotion magazines or instances in newspapers or pamphlets, treatises, various kinds of guidebooks. That's another really important source, and trying to just to get as much of this as possible and look at the ways in which tourism is imagined, in which these places are presented and conceived, and how the tourists themselves are imagined as actors. And so there was a lot of just hoarding. And it was in the process of hoarding that I first kind of got turned on to this hyper interest in Americans. Because I wasn't really looking at, I was trying to look at tourism within Hungary and within Austria and between those two countries as a post-imperial experience. But in both cases, what I found, it was a hyper interest and sensitivity to the inclinations and desires of Anglophone tourists, whether that's, you know, Britons broadly defined or Americans broadly defined. And so this paper came out of wanting to explore more why it was that Austrians in particular were so keen on Americans, even though statistically they only made up something like 4 to 6% any given year of the number of tourists who came to Austria in the interwar period. And so this paper now, to give an indication of how much things have changed in the last 10 to 15 years, I did most of this research using the ANO database of the digitized newspapers to the Austrian National Library, which has a robust keyword search. Every page is digitized. You can download it as PDFs. I mean, it's just, it's a dream come true for someone who isn't able to go physically to Austria very much at all for many reasons. And so that process was kind of running a dragnet through these newspaper archives through ANO and trying to understand the contours and the details of the interwar years and looking at, you know, the mentions of American tourists in those papers.
Well, I'm happy to see its continued development.
Me too. Me too. And I'll just say again, like the conference was wonderful in directing me into, you know, different corners and to seeing things in a widened perspective. And I'm not saying this just because I'm on the Botschtieber podcast, but it really was one of those conferences you want to go to where everyone is in that room at the panel because they're interested in this topic. And everyone who is there has something specific, concrete, and interesting to contribute to this topic because, you know, this is their world. And it was really productive and wonderful to have that opportunity.
What do you see as the future of the project? What are the questions that you would most like to answer still?
Well, one thing is that I'm excited to get around to reading The Battle for Vienna or the Kampf um Wien by Hugo Bettauer and this early 1920s novel talking about the anxieties of the rich American coming and possibly transforming Vienna and Austria in this malign sort of way. That was something that was a big hook for me coming out of the conference. So I want to understand better the bigger picture of how Americans are perceived in early interwar Austria and whether or not the image, the fairly neutral, if not generally positive image that comes out of the newspaper press is reflective of other attitudes or broader attitudes. I also want to try to understand some of why the interest in American tourists seems to taper off or at least become less pronounced after 1931, 1932 or so, and whether that is just a product of the Depression and the fact that Americans stopped coming in even the numbers that they do for several years, and whether that's the Austrian promoters are looking elsewhere to greener pastures, whether that's Hungary or Europe more broadly, or they're becoming distracted by the tensions with Germany and the fact that German tourism is cratering in the early 1930s, and the, you know, the question of whether or not Austria will remain a sovereign country, whether this is a question of political changes, whether the Vaterländische Front and so-called Austrofascism is responsible for thinking less about Americans or thinking more broadly about other tourism markets. These are things that I'd like to pursue, because the whole story of the rise and fall of American tourism to Austria in the interwar period has some hazy spots that need to be cleared up.
How do you think the average person listening to this podcast should take this information, take this story, and use it to help better understand the world around them or these countries? Like, what are the main ideological takeaways from this research?
I think as an American, and especially as an American whose relationship to Austria in particular has been not exclusively touristic, but I mean, practically, you know, that interacting with it as a temporary visitor and interacting with the outside world as a temporary visitor for the most part, I think it's really worth looking at in trying to get a more circumspect picture of the place of Americans in the world and thinking about how much that has changed or hasn't changed in the last 100 years, trying to think about whether or not how we perceive ourselves as Americans in the wider world is really unique in our present moment, or whether it is, you know, the latest moment in a much broader arc going back to the early 20th century, possibly before. I do think that there is World War I is definitely a major turning point. And I guess also thinking more intensely and more thoughtfully about what the future might be, and, you know, as far as how the world perceives Americans and what American culture it looks like on the ground in other places, and how people in those other places relate to that culture in ways that are more complicated than I think that we as Americans just simply kind of landing over there might assume. By way of an example, so I have a young son. One of the things that I was interested to see when I was in Vienna this last time is whether or not the Austrian consciousness has been so thoroughly penetrated by the TV show Bluey, the way that the American consciousness has been. And, you know, we're talking about soft power. I mean, that's got to be one of the great coups of Australian soft power in history. And I didn't notice it very much. I mean, there was a little display in the Morava bookstore in Vienna of Bluey translated into German. But I was surprised to see in Vienna and in Budapest a surprisingly large number of Paw Patrol bags and kids' clothes and stuff like that. So from a TV show that I think of as being very American in its relationship to authority and to the police and firefighters and emergency, that's a whole rich tapestry as far as American relationships with those things. But then to see that so visible in these other places, I couldn't help but wonder, you know, how do these kids relate to these images? What do they think of? I mean, what is it that they are imagining that these police dogs represent or don't represent? Do they think of them as being American or simply kind of generically, you know, action adventure dogs? I don't know. I wasn't there interviewing those kids on the U-Bahn, but it did occur to me, like, this is an example of where you've got a cultural institution and you've got these cultural signifiers and cultural products that are broadcast into the world, and they are being picked up, adopted, adapted, worn, consumed in ways that are, you know, that go far beyond what Americans might imagine. And I think as by way of conclusion, we can already start to see that and think about that in the 1920s.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being on.
No, thank you, Luke, for having me on, and thank you to the Bosch-Huber Foundation for the support and for a great conference.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the episode. Remember to check the episode description to find more from our guest. Follow us on social media or turn on notifications to get alerts for future episodes. The Bosch-Huber Institute for Austrian American Studies promotes an understanding of the historic relationship between the United States and Austria, including the lands of the former Habsburg Empire, by awarding grants and fellowships, organizing lectures and conferences, and publishing the Journal of Austrian American History. We engage with a broader public audience through digital programming, including videos, podcasts, and blog posts. Auf Wiedersehen, and see you next time.